The great being here and listening also to the other presentations and reading the papers, which is really inspiring. And what I'm going to present here is collaborative work, and it's work in progress. So first of all, I feel I have to apologize that the paper isn't that ready or polished. So it should be in a different stage, but we had some problems with the deadline, so we had to submit. So the second half of the paper might look a little bit messy, but we see this is the first time we are presenting this here, so it's really work in progress, and we do not recycle anything. So we actually worked on this paper for this workshop only. Okay, my co-author is Dimpo Motsamai. She works for the ISS, the Institute for Security Studies, in Pretoria. And as I said, this is collaborative work. My part is more on the African Union side and the relationship between the African Union and the UN and EU. And Dimpo is more a specialist in SADC and the RECs and relationship to the African Union. So this is somehow how we divided work among ourselves. Okay, so the paper looks at the African peace and security regime, not the architecture. I think it's important to make a differentiation here, because the so-called peace and security architecture or EPSA is only an African regime. And the attempt, what we're trying to do in this paper is to look at the interaction of all international, of most international organizations that are involved in African security issues, and that does involve African as well as non-African actors, naturally. Good. So what we're actually doing, we're not only involved in issues of regionalism only, but we're also looking at how regional actors are connected then with the external world of non-African actors. I think this is also an issue that's almost important for every regional organization in Africa itself. What the other focus of this paper is on the interplay and interaction of international organizations. And I think this is an important issue, especially for Africa, because Africa is presumably the continent with the highest density of regional organizations. And there's a lot of overlap in terms of multiple memberships of states and different organizations. I think we have around 12 or 13 different RECs on the African continent, and that's quite massive. So whatever you do, whatever policy area you're looking at, there's always interaction and overplay. So the issue of how these actors are cooperating, working together, or not cooperating is important. I would say, and this is also a particular feature of African regionalism. But we also set it in a context of a global system. So it's an interlocking system of global and regional governance. And so we take a very comprehensive look, which is a very challenging task, both theoretically and empirically, because we have to work on so many issues, right, at different levels. Okay, so we are also taking, I would say, in many ways, a rather non-traditional approach. We're not looking at theories of integration, not really. We're not looking at new regionalism, for instance. But the starting point is organization theory, right? And the organization theorists, when it comes to the interaction of organizations, which can be many institutions, not only international organizations, but we are looking only at security and international organizations active in Africa. They are focusing on resource exchange. And I think that's a nice term, because it's also neutral. It doesn't imply that there's a sending and receiving organization. So it is, resource exchange can be many things. Resources are basically all those kinds that can be exchanged, and are those kinds for which there's demand and supply. So it can be material or immaterial. The main focus empirically, again, is on security, and there's a heavy focus on peacekeeping. The reason being that this is more easy to grasp, actually. The flow of following the flow of ideas is really a tricky business. So, of course, we have to limit our focus here. Okay, organization theory and the exchange of resources is that's a very rational approach. Well, they are basically saying that, okay, cooperation is attractive if organizations can establish a mutual beneficial exchange of resources, whatever these resources are. So this is very close to rational institutionalism. It's about cost effectiveness and maybe also some kind of output efficiency. And if we look at security matters and peacekeeping in Africa, the times of, for instance, UN peacekeeping only are basically over, right? In most cases of peacekeeping operations, you have, of peacekeeping missions, you have some kind of cooperation between international actors, be it between the EU and UN, the AU and the UN, or be it between the RECs and the African Union. And this is true for at least, I think, 80% of operations. So just taking the focus of one organization does really miss the point. There's more that is going on, and we are interested in what is going on between these institutions. And at the beginning, this rather rational and functional approach where organization theorists are saying that, okay, cooperation is likely when organizations complement each other and fill out capability gaps, that at the beginning makes a lot of sense. And if you look at the peacekeeping capabilities of different actors, you will find out that no individual actor, be it African, non-African, is actually able in addressing Africa's security needs. And the UN is overstretched. If you look at the literature on UN peacekeeping, they reach their limits. If you look at the African contribution, the so-called African standby forces, the idea that are there, they have plans for maximum 20,000-25,000 troops. If you look at the European concepts and engagement in the past, EU battle groups, although I know they have not been deployed, but the battle groups are important because they provide the concept, the idea of what the European Union can and wants to provide. This battle group concept then accounts for some, I think, maximum of 3,000 troops deployed in one operation, for instance. So you can clearly see that when you look at an operation like the DRC or Somalia, where you have around 12 to 20,000 troops in one operation, you can clearly see that no individual actor is actually capable enough of setting up missions. So they are very much reliant on each other. And the EU, for instance, only deployed with cooperation with the UN, right? And the African Union was very much reliant on the capability of the UN to take over. There are many more examples in that area. So at the beginning, this functional logic seems to work quite well. But if you dig a little bit deeper and look at many other issues, you start wondering if cooperation is just a functional exchange of capability limitations, if it really works like this, right? We found out then there's no automaticity, right, between the functional need when resource pooling makes sense because it's burden sharing, so it's more efficient. Now that would be a very rational approach to peacekeeping cooperation. We found out that there are many cases where functionally it would make sense, but they do not really cooperate. So there are many intervening variables that come into place here. And we're interested in finding out also what are these variables and how is this rational logic changed a little bit. And this is work we've just started. A quick note on methodology before I go through different hypotheses that are in the paper. So our approach is not a classical testing of theories or testing of hypotheses. So, I mean, in a traditional science view, it is either or, right? You show that one independent variable is causally significant, then you've won somehow, right? Or if it's not causally significant, then, well, you somehow lost. And this either or, I think in most cases these days, it's problematic. It's problematic because there are many individual factors that have a multiple impact on a certain outcome. So it's much more interesting to see how many different factors have an impact at the same time and causing a certain outcome. So therefore, we deviate from this classical view of just theory testing, and there must be a positive outcome. We assume that there will be counterexamples to our hypothesis, and we are fine with that. What we apply is then the method of congruence. So if we find then cases that support our hypothesis, we are fine, but we are aware that there are also other cases that would actually contradict us. But we think that we can live with this, because our attempt is to show how the functional and rational logic is not always working, and therefore we are fine if there is congruence and not causal impact. Okay, so the functional logic, that's a starting beginning, and what else is happening? And we have formulated a number of hypotheses, and another additional hypothesis is that the greater the mismatch of institutional security culture strategies and goals between IOs, the more difficult the exchange of resources. So in a nutshell, deviating security concepts matter, right? And the fact that international actors have different ideas about, for instance, when to deploy peacekeeping operations, when to set up peacekeeping operations, or what they should do, for instance, then this can overrule the logic of burden sharing or resource pooling. And they are nice examples. For instance, the UN is quite straightforward in saying, especially after the Brahimi report and the experience in Rwanda, Srebrenica, and Somalia, that there must be a peace to keep on the ground. There must be a stable ceasefire agreement, at least that's a minimum condition. Then we are willing to send UN peacekeepers there. The African Union has a different approach. I mean, they deployed in situations where the UN does not want to deploy. And the premier example would be Somalia. I mean, AU deployed in 2007. From the beginning, they said, please, UN, take over, take over, take over. The UN still saying, no, this is our security doctrine, does not allow us to do it. Right, and this is one example where you have this deviation. Another nice example would be also deviation between Europe and Africa when it comes to, for instance, the ICC and the question of impunity and how to prosecute, for instance, war crimes. Right, so the European Union now, in the case of Gaddafi, is very much supporting the ICC. It must be prosecuted. That's the only solution. African Union is taking a different position here. And the reason is that we do have different norms in Africa. I mean, the African Union is a revamped organization. It's not the OAU, which was known for being a club of dictators, nurturing culture of impunity, and so on. So there is progress, but you still have, I mean, what the AU is at the moment is they're promoting a policy of non-indifference. But they don't really know what this actually means. So human rights, right, this is important, humanitarian law is important, but how to implement, how to operationalize this is not really clear. And at the moment you can see a big divergence between Europe and Africa. So that would be a number of examples from that perspective. So technically it would make sense, for instance, to pool resources between the AU and UN in the case of Somalia, because of course the UN is much more resourceful, rich organization, right, and it's a bit unfair to let the much poorer African Union do a very difficult job here. But because of these different security cultures and doctrines, they do actually not cooperate, although it would make a lot of sense. Another point is that, again, in a nutshell, institutional setups matter. And one of our hypotheses is that the greater the divergence between institutional setups, the more difficult the exchange of resources. Well, that at the beginning sounds quite okay, but there's a slight problem with causality here. So if we overrate the factor that institutions matter, then we would have a problem here. Okay, but institutions do actually matter. So resource exchange, right, is channeled through institutions. So the assumption that institutions matter should not be very much surprising in itself. Well, if we look at different actors, we can see at the surface, for instance, that is quite interesting, that the EU, AU, and UN have a similar setup, right? The UN Security Council, the African Union Peace and Security Council, and the EU Political and Security Committee are all intergovernmental bodies, and on paper they look similar. But below that level, for instance, they are structured differently. And one study is saying there was someone who was analyzing response times of the EU versus the AU, and she found out that, and her conclusion is that, okay, the EU is much slower in responding because it's a more bureaucratic institution, right? And that way institutions matter. For instance, that is one example. One example from the relationship between the RECs and the African Union is that there's a lack sometimes of docking stations, as I would call it. So if institutions do vary greatly in terms of the competences they have or the procedures, how they are structured, then communication is difficult. And we can clearly see that in the case of, for instance, SADC and the African Union. Well, the African Union now has a Peace and Security Council, and this is the most authoritative institution when it comes to security and Africa. But there is no equivalent at the sub-region level in the SADC region. There is no Security Council of the SADC region. So there's a problem with communication between the headquarters level in Addis and the level headquarters level at Gaborone. There's only an organ for politics and security. And this person is not, SADC is not a supranational institution. So this is a much lower level, right? So again, these are some examples of where institutions matter. Also, again, one must be careful with not overrating the impact of institutions. For instance, response time of the European Union do vary a lot. Also, in each time, the decision-making process was going through the same institutions. So how do we explain this variance, for instance? Okay, another factor we looked at is the strive for political independence. So we also assume that international organizations want to make an independent visual contribution in a case where the pooling of resources would lead to marginalization, yeah, or an organization becoming completely invisible, then cooperation is not attractive whatsoever. So although resource pooling would technically functionally be attractive, the strive for political autonomy holds organizations back, and this is also not an easy condition, but there are indicators that we can see some turf battles between organizations. It is not a coincidence that the African Union has not deployed any peacekeeping operation in the ECOWAS area, for instance. So somehow Western Africa, also it is very far developed in its institutional structure, and ECOWAS was and is a region that is pushing, right, for more integration. They are advanced. Nigeria is, of course, standing behind this as a hegemon. But somehow then the African Union doesn't have much influence in that area, right? On the other hand, there was a lot of discussion between SADC and the African Union with regard to the crisis in Madagascar. And SADC took an approach of, this is our area, African Union don't have any business here. Functionally, technically, that doesn't make sense. If you can get more resources, for instance, or create more political pressures from more organizations, that should be regarded as something positive, right? But obviously, there's a political agenda behind this, and there's some kind of politics around there that you want to shield away sometimes the African Union influence. You want to keep it in the region. Okay, so these are we have these three further conditions. So basically we say for resource exchange, for cooperation, you need to have at the beginning this functional incentive, yeah? So if organizations can complement each other, that's great. But this logic in itself is broken quite often, and it's broken through a number of conditions. One is the normative side, so congruence of norms, for instance, or deviation of norms. And then we have the diverging institutional setups. They do matter as well. And then the strive for political independence. Again, I think one must be careful with not essentializing one of these I would call them rather intervening variables here, so that would be a mistake. But we are further developing this concept, and we hope to really fine-tune and fine-grain this paper also with your comments. Thank you very much.